the Contracting Officer Podcast. Whether you work for government or industry, if you're in the government acquisition world, we're here to help you understand how the other side thinks. Our mission, to make government contracts better, one contract at a time. This episode is brought to you by Skyway Acquisition Solutions. Skyway helps companies of all sizes know more, do more, and win more in the government market. Visit skywayacquisition.com to learn more. Okay, let's get started. Hey, Kevin, today we're going to take a little bit of a departure from our usual program and answer some questions that came out of your recent webinar with the Association of Proposal Management Professionals, the APMP.
We are, Paul, and proposal managers, they have a different view of the proposal process than the contracting officers. I got some really kind of interesting questions when I was doing this webinar, and I wanted to talk through it with you to find out if our answers would be the same.
Okay, to center this in the acquisition time zones, these questions come from the RFP zone and the source selection zone. We're talking about proposal managers here, so they don't really deal so much with the requirement zone and the market research zone. They're more focused on when the RFP comes out and what happens after it's submitted, the proposal is submitted. Let's give a little background where these questions came from. The APMP hosted a webinar that you spoke on from the contracting officer's perspective of the proposal process. So during the webinar, there were questions, but the webinar is too short to field them all. And after the session, tons of more questions came in, and it was a really interesting viewpoint from proposal managers. Again, they're focused on the proposal process and the compliance part more so than contracts people or technical people or capture people or anybody else that's involved.
Yeah, and the reason that this was a lot of fun to give the presentation on to the APMP folks is that a lot of times, we talked about this in other episodes, a lot of times the contracting officer and the proposal manager never actually meet each other. And like I would not have been able to pick out a proposal manager in a crowd when I was a contracting officer. And it was really cool to be able to give them the perspective of why what they do matters to the contracting officer, how you can influence the process to go more smoothly. And likewise, as a contracting officer, understand that when you do this in an RFP, here's the flurry of activity, as to use your term, cascading activity that it creates. So it was a great webinar. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Question number one. Are contracting officers required to apply proposal compliance uniformly across all bidders? And to expand on that question, they gave it for example. For example, let's say a CO gets 25 proposals and they want to cut down quickly down to 5 proposals because you don't want to have to evaluate everything. So what do? You use the compliance cutoff. So Company A and Company Z both use the wrong font size. Company A is an unknown bidder, but Company Z is the incumbent contractor and they have a very strong performance record. So if the CO uses the font size to remove Company A, the unknown bidder, from the evaluation pool, must the CO also remove Company Z, the incumbent? So applying professional judgment here, could the contracting officer permit Company Z to remain in the evaluation pool despite the fact that they're non-compliant just like Company A? So that's kind of a long explanation for a simple question. Do you have to apply proposal compliance uniformly as a CO?
So we'll start with the book answer, which is yes, you have to treat everyone exactly the same. However, there's always a however, right? That the CO can use basically selectively decide what non-compliance elements are worth having clarifications over. And remember that clarifications is essentially something simple like, hey, did you mean to say it this way? And the answer is yes or no, that kind of thing. But they can decide which ones they want to get really, really technical about. And the however number two is they have 25 proposals, so the CO is trying to get to one offer, right? I mean, they're trying to award one contract, and they may not want to nix the incumbent. So there are lots of companies to choose from. They're trying to thin this down and find a process that gets them to ones that they want to select to move on to the competitive range. So the book answer is they're going to treat everybody the same. That being said, I've had to eliminate a preferred, in quotes, incumbent more than once because of stuff like this. And the reality is that it's really hard to defend this. There's a lot of issues with, we're using a simple example of font size, right? But it could be something like they forgot a section or they didn't attach I mean, I actually had one that they forgot to attach one of the elements of the proposal. And as much as we loved them, it's like, dude, I can't overlook that. So, I mean, it's not something usually as simple as font size. It's more the definition of compliance is, do you have a complete proposal? So think of it that way. And that's where I had to kick a couple people out. But it really comes down to the decision of, can I selectively ignore this issue on one proposal and then not on another one? And that's a tough case to make. So a lot of times what happens from my perspective is it's things like there's a peer review. Somebody's going to look over your shoulder after you pick the five companies that make it to the competitive range. And that person may not have this emotional connection to the contractor. So as a result, they're going to be more hardcore on, yeah, you got to kick this guy out because he was non-compliant. So think of it. All that stuff's happening in the background. So be very careful of hoping that you can get around some of these non-compliance issues.
I remember one situation where there were only two offers, and one of the offers, there was a list of six or eight attachments that were supposed to be with the proposal, and one of the offers did not have attachment C in their proposal. I don't remember which attachment it was. It might have been B. Who cares? But because we only had two, and because we wanted a real competition between them, made that a clarification. You know, did you intend to include attachment C with your proposal? Why, yes, we did. Here it is, was the answer. In the end, could I have thrown them out? Could I have just evaluated one proposal? Yes, but it really didn't make sense for the government to throw them out when it was an honest, you know, clerical mistake that one didn't make it in the box, because I think we're just using paper at the time, sadly enough.
And to extend on this topic a little bit, the idea of who makes it into the competitive range is kind of like what you just talked about. You only had two companies, right? Well, given this 25 companies, that's a big assumption that company, I think it was Company Z, the one that they talked about being the incumbent. Right. Company Z, let's say that we want to keep them. But think about it this way. What if you only got, like you just talked about, you only get three, right? Well, now Company Z is, we want to have Company Z in here. What oftentimes happens is if in a very competitive environment, if it's only under $1 million, it's not something that's going to get reviewed by, you know, lots and lots of people. And you get 25 offers, even though Z was the incumbent, there may be five other companies that didn't mess it up that their proposal looks just as good as Z. So if your Company Z and you're hanging your hat on, hey, well, they should have kept us in because we're the incumbent, That's a perilous path to go down, because in a really competitive environment, contracting officer, while it breaks their heart, and again, I've done this, it breaks their heart a little bit to say, well, the company that's been doing this for 5 years, I hate to kick him out on a perceived technicality that, you know, they didn't give me a complete proposal.
Perceived?
It's perceived, because when they get that letter that says you're not in the competitive range because you didn't include this one thing, their answer, and again, I've been in a debriefing with Shelley. She's on our, I used to work with her. And the guy said, well, you know, we can do that. We could have submitted that part of the proposal. And Shelley's answer was, but you didn't. And that's, it
and
sounds
oh,
like,
oh, they were pissed.
Oh, they're mad. And that's a great example of, as a contracting officer, you had other really good, strong competitors. Now, to your point, if you don't, that's a judgment call. So, but don't hang your hat on that judgment call playing your way. That's kind of the point I wanted to hammer home there.
All right, so bottom line, RCO is required to apply proposal compliance uniformly across all bidders. The answer is yes, of course they are, but no, maybe sometimes they don't. But if you're on the industry side, do not leave this to chance. This is the easiest part of the proposal, is following the rules they write down. If they say Times New Roman 12 is the font that you shall use, use it. Don't leave it to chance that maybe just because, you know, you like Calibri or whatever it is better, don't leave it to chance that they'll say, oh, that's fine.
And it's not even just the font size. It's things like the number of past performance references, or the number of pages that you have to explain this point versus that point.
Right.
Or did you cover how much the product weighs? I mean, there's stuff like that that, you know, I said I needed to know how much this product weighs in order to be able to evaluate it. They didn't have that in their proposal. I had to kick them out. Yep. That's one thing. It probably took like, I don't know, what, six characters, because it was a couple of pounds, right? But it wasn't there. All right. We beat that one to death. Let's move on.
During the webinar, you talked about two different types of contracting officers, and these are broad generalizations, so don't everybody get all mad about this. But One type of contracting officer is the kind that focuses on the rules, the regulations, and the FAR clauses, and we're going to call that the compliance CO. The other type of contracting officer follows all that kind of stuff, but they rely more on their judgment than the black and white of it all. We're going to call that the judgment CO, not that they're judging you, but that they rely on their judgment. So compliance CO, judgment CO, two different broad stereotypical types.
And to throw in our little FAR reference, you can see where I got these if you read FAR 1.602. It kind of talks about the two extremes of a contracting officer's responsibility.
Good job sneaking that in there. I like that.
FAR reference.
So the real question is, assuming that the proposal staff doesn't know which type of CO that is on here, compliance or judgment, we need to write for both. How do we meet the needs of both types of COs simultaneously? And this goes back, there is a relationship part. This is 80-20 rule again. Compliance is big. You got to follow all the rules. But if you don't have the relationships, if you don't know your customer and know what kind of CO you have, you're kind of hampering your proposal efforts, right?
Yeah, and this is a really good example of that, how that 20% plays a bigger part in the process the closer you get to winning. And what I mean by that is, we talked in a previous podcast about, you get to the end and it's down to just the contracting officer or the source selection authority. It's got to pick one. They got to pick somebody. Let's say they got three blue proposals and they're all really close on price. They're probably going to pick the one that they know. You know, unless it's a 20% price difference or something, they're going to go based on, hey, this is a company we've heard of, they're an incumbent, et cetera, right? So that's the relationship part. Well, this is another example of that is if you don't know the customer that well, you're going to spend a lot of time with extra words on things that don't really apply to them. And you gobble up, you say you only got 10 pages to tell your story. You gobble up a lot of time on extra. And that extra stuff, the compliance CO is going to ignore. And the judgment CO may be looking for it, but if it's not talking to them, they're going to ignore it. And that's why this is a perilous path. So how do you write to both? Well, the easier to write to is the compliance CO. Just meet the metric. But understand that the judgment CO is going to be reading through this proposal looking for, tell me you can do this. Make me comfortable that when I sign this contract that my name is on forever, that you're going to be able to deliver.
Right.
That's not a compliance feeling. That's a, I want to trust that you can actually do this work.
Yeah, so it's still, you still have to be compliant, or the judgment CO, no matter how confident they are, can't award it to you. They'll get crushed in a protest, right? But
okay, fair
the
enough.
Way that you write is a little more maybe colorful. It doesn't have to be so black and white linked to the compliance. You still have to prove you're compliant everywhere, but there's more opportunity to make the sales pitch. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and for the contracting officers who are listen to our podcast
and seething right now,
and this is a great example. So I was a judgment CO. There were people I drove them crazy because I was probably an extreme judgment CO, and then I had folks that I worked with who were extreme compliance COs. Most people were in the middle, and so I'm curious to see the podcast listeners who are contracting officers if they see themselves fitting on one side or the other. But understand that the proposal manager doesn't know which one you're on, is trying to write to both. And you'll start to see that somebody who did the shaping, they did the effort, they did the research, they've been tracking your agency, you're going to see that language, and they're probably going to be writing to, and again, it's not just a contracting officer reading the proposal, I get that. But the idea is, this same principle could apply to the evaluators. It could apply to the lawyers. Everybody is going to see these proposals in the same light of, yes, you met the absolute minimum, or do you know me?
Yeah, that expands on the question. The question was more specific to the two types of contracting officers that you were describing in the webinar. But if you think about it from the perspective of knowing your customer, it's like you just said, it's everybody on the evaluation team, including the SSA, if you can figure out who that is, writing to them is a better path to success. You know, if you know the guy really likes blue, make all your graphics some shade of blue. that's really probably not true.
Well, and so going back to the contracting officer part, if you have a compliance CO and you've written your proposal just to be able to hit the compliance, it's going to be easier for them to make the decision to award to you. However, the downside to that is, guess what they're probably going to be deciding on? Price. Because if you've taken all of that uniqueness of what you do out of the story, you're slipping into, don't be surprised if you end up with an LPTA feel to it.
Yeah.
So that, and so I'll close this question with the idea of, is there a way for you to tell which type you're writing to? And most of the time, it's interesting, interesting question to consider. Most of the time, I think people just, they write to compliance and then add some colorful graphics and whatnot. It's, that's kind of how I felt I got most of the proposals that I saw.
Yeah, I think they assume contracts people shade towards that compliance side. That's the personality type that tends to thrive in a contracts type of role.
Yeah, well said. So I think that if you had, so this is a fun exercise. If you had to pick one, write to the compliance one, obviously, because that's going to get you in the gate, right?
Yeah, but you'll still make it through the judgment CEO's hoops if you write to the compliance one. If you go the other direction and don't focus on the compliance side, you might never make it.
Well, and here's the fun part, though, is that you'll make it through the first gate, but I don't think you're as likely to win. Yeah. Because in the end, yes, you showed up, and again, I'm putting a facetious angle on this, but it's like you showed up and did the minimum. And again, I've gotten proposals. I had four or five of them, and the ones that were green and were decent price. But then here's this one that's blue, and it's 10% more. That 10% more that I've justified paying is because they had written to the judgment side also. So understand that. So the simplest way to think of this is that to get through the first gate, you need to be compliant. To win through the competitive range, you're probably going to need to write to the judgment CEO, and that's why I think you need to write to both.
Nice. Moving on to question three. Next question is, what do page limitations tell us about the government's evaluation approach? And the expansion upon that the questioner wrote was, some RFPs have page limits, some do not. Some have page limitations that seem excessive, meaning that the proposal instructions are longer than the space permitted for the response. And this is funny. It says, is the CO just being lazy and wants fewer pages to evaluate? Or is it a technique for avoiding protest? It's easier to say a bidder didn't satisfy the requirement or fully describe the approach, you know, if you don't give them enough space. And further, if there's no page limit on the proposal, then does the CO expect every SAO requirement to be literally restated verbatim and then the approach addressed in detail down to the most nebulous? And the example is like cabinet door size. So that's a big question, but let's talk about page limitations and where they come from and what that means about the way the government's going to evaluate things.
The way that I think of this is, a lot of times it's because the limitation was there last time. So last time we did this competition, it was a 50-page limit, so we'll make it a 50-page limit. Or it could just be a guess based on 20 sounds good, 50 sounds good, 10 sounds good. I mean, I've actually done that where I thought, well, okay, there are five different sections they got to talk through. We'll give them 3 pages per section, 15, right? And it's part of this is that you're expecting to get some pushback because, for the record, I've never had anyone ask for fewer pages. So the assumption is that if I tell you 15 and you come back and during the draft RFP or even during the RFP, after the RFP drops, and you say, no, I can't do this in 3 pages, can we have more? So the assumption from a contracting officer perspective is I'm expecting you're going to ask for more pages because I've never had anybody. and here's the other part is that the assumption is there's going to be fluff in there. And that sounds really snarky, but I got to tell you, how many times you go to a website, pick any website, and you look at how much on there is just extra, whether it's the graphics or there's just more words or things are spread out more. And pick a reason. But the perception is that there's going to be fluff. It's funny. Shelley calls it blah, blah. It's like, and you look at any kind of marketing material, it's just blah, blah. So the assumption as a contracting officer is if I give you 50 pages, you probably could answer it in 30 or maybe even 10. I don't know. And you're going to give me fluff. And so the story I use with this one, one of the first proposals that I helped a company win, or first proposals we wrote for a company, helped them win a contract back in when I started Skyway. The proposal limit was 30 pages, and we wrote the whole thing in 27. And the CEO of the company says, do we need to fill it? I'm like, no, we answered the mail in 20. It's okay to not use all 30. And we ended up winning it. And it was an interesting point for me because that was one of the first times I did it from the other side. and showed that we, this 30, they may have been guessing. It may have been the standard from last time. And we sure enough did not need all 30. So
I got to say, I've never seen one not fill every page. It takes tremendous self-control because you have 30 pages. We got to use them. Sometimes those that extra 3 pages of crap is just distracting and makes your proposal worse. Yeah. In my perspective, I think a lot of times the limitations, like you said, I agree, it comes from boilerplate instructions. They get the last acquisition that was done, and it said 10-page technical proposal, 5-page management proposal, and that's what they leave in there. And that is bad form. Every acquisition is different. You got to think about these things. Sometimes the evaluation team that's going to do this source selection says, I think that they need that industry needs 20 pages to describe this, or 10 pages, whatever. Sometimes, and the best way to do it, a lot of times I would ask industry, how many pages do you need to describe this fully? And use their feedback. They're not going to tell you that they need more pages than they do, because then they got to write more. But it still might be a little bigger than you expect. What it comes down to is just saying submit a proposal and leaving it open for industry to submit whatever they want gives you all of that blah, blah, and fluff and pages and pages and pages to evaluate to try to find what you need to know to actually evaluate the offer. In a time-compressed world, if you have 10 proposals that are 10 pages or 10 proposals that are unlimited, so you get a 10-pager and a 50-pager and a 100-pager, you have no way in advance of creating any kind of source selection schedule because you don't know how long it's going to take to evaluate. So my example here is my favorite class, my favorite MBA class. You know, college professors are renowned for thinking that the rest of the world operates in a academic world where you write long academic papers with footnotes and references and all this kind of stuff. So most classes focused on writing long papers. You'd have 20-page papers and you'd have to footnote and reference and everything. But in the real world, that doesn't exist, right? Only academia, only professional journals have that kind of stuff. If you're in the real business world, you get at most a page to describe what you're talking about. Probably even less than that. In the email world, you might get a couple bullets to get the CEO to sell your point to the CEO. Favorite MBA class, 10-week class, there were 10 one-page papers due, one each week, and the topic that you had to write to, I swear, took at least 10 pages to properly explain. And you had to figure out how to condense your thoughts down to one page. And I learned more from that class than I think any other class, because that's how the world works. And that's what I'm talking about with the reason I'm telling the story. I'm linking it to proposals, right? It is very, very difficult to compress 20 pages of content into 10 pages. So there's got to be some sanity looking at the RFP requirements. What are your evaluation criteria? If you have 10 different evaluation criteria and you say you have 10 pages to submit, you may get a bunch of proposals that don't make any sense because they literally don't have enough space to answer the mail. If you have 2 evaluation criteria and give them 20 pages, you'll never be able to find where the real answers are in those 20 pages. So there is a link between what's in the RFP and how many pages it takes. But when in doubt, I think the idea is to shade towards asking for less pages. And industry, it's much harder to write to less pages, but it weeds out all the fluff and the blah, blah, because you only have a tiny bit of space. So you can only include the most important things to say. So as a CEO, I would say I would shade towards not enough pages. As industry, I hate that. I mean, I don't want to write 50 pages, but if it's a huge program, trying to explain it in 50 pages when you need 100 pages, there's a point, there's a sweet spot, but there's a point where it becomes impossible to actually tell your story and meet all of the evaluation criteria if you don't have enough pages to do it. And that's where the government's evaluation gets very difficult.
Yeah, that's good stuff. And so here's my personal example of the compression exercise you just described. When I did a TEDx talk, just Google Why the Micro Niche is Mighty. It's about the podcast.
Nice plug.
And it's a great example because it was to describe to people how hard it was for somebody to say, tell me why micro niches count why podcasting counts and why I should start a podcast. Tell me all of that effectively in under 18 minutes.
Yeah, and you started out like with a 45-minute presentation. Oh,
it was a mess. It was crazy. But that exercise, and so the reason I'm this is a really good topic to talk about is that the contracting officer in me had no idea when I sent out a 20-page limit, because any story could be told in 100 pages. I mean, you know, go read a Dickens novel. It's a little bit long, right? I mean, or an Ayn Rand book. There's examples of you can, in an infinite world, you can always take more space. But to compress it down, it is an adventure. And realizing that time it takes and the value of it. I mean, this isn't a complaining exercise. This is a point of you want a compressed story. Understand that a compressed story takes time. And give people credit for giving you a compressed story that's effective. I'm not trying to plug my TED talk. Go to TED.com and watch some of them, and you'll see what I mean. It's like those talks take months of planning.
No fluff, no blah, blah, blah. Just the point.
To tell a really huge story in under 18 minutes, some of them are under 5 minutes. It's really amazing to me how effective you can do that. So take that concept. And so going back to this question of why are page limitations done and why is it as much like a lot of things we talk about, it's as much art as science. Sometimes we're guessing. Sometimes it's based on past performance. Sometimes it's based on what's worked in the past. Sometimes it's just a matter of this should work. Let's see if it does. And then a lot of times what it should be based on is that industry, here's what we think. What do you think?
Yep. Communication up front is the key to getting it right, because maybe I know this is crazy. Maybe 17 pages is the right number. Although I've never seen anyone use anything but multiples of 5, I don't think. But, you know.
That's a really good point. Challenge out. Use a prime number. I picked 23 pages. Sorry. Nice. That's funny.
All right. I think this is great questions from a group of people who spend their time working proposals over and over and over, but have a unique viewpoint compared to some of the other people in the acquisition process and in the proposal process.
So today's request is tell a friend who is a proposal manager or who writes proposals or who touches proposals at all about the Contracting Officer podcast, because there's a lot of value in talking to people in different parts of the acquisition process. You heard us talk one of the podcast episodes about the players. Well, not all those players are Googling Contracting Officer podcast. So think about all the players in this whole process, and one of them would be the proposal teams. And if you know anybody who works in that vein, let them know about the podcast and see if we can get them listening, because we're just trying to give this information away for free. So please help them find it.
That's a great point. Our badly named podcast, the Contracting Officer Podcast, makes it sound like it's just for contracting officers, but it's for the industry contracts people, and it's for anybody in that government contracting world to understand more about it, the contracts part of it. All right. Good times. Talk to you later, Kevin.
All right. See you, Paul.
That's it for this episode of the Contracting Officer Podcast. As always, if you have questions, comments, or complaints, send me an email at paul@contractingofficerpodcast.com. Thanks for joining us.